body hears the word peace for the first time, he might think how this word could be shown in a museum. Well, I tell you how. In fact, Tehran Peace Museum is a place for disseminating the culture of peace and friendship via showcasing the dire consequences of war and violence, as well as its harmful impacts on humans and the environment. Well, let's take a tour around the museum. The Peace Museum of Tehran consists of a library, an art gallery for peace, workshops, the virtual section of the museum, and a studio for recording oral history. This museum has a main hall which contains symbols for representing war consequences in the world and the consequences of using chemical weapons. Well, from where can we start? Let me take a look at these sculptures. Yes. Very interesting. They seem to be very real. Here you can see sculptures that are the same size of a normal human being. And here there are busts of famous figures, be it peace-seeking or belligerent. Oh, look at this. This is the bust of Gandhi. Gandhi fought against British colonization. And this is the bust of Hitler. The initiator of the Second World War and the killer of innocent people. Oh, and this is Saddam, the Ba'athist dictator who, with the help of Western countries, especially the US, imposed the 8-year war against Iran. Shoes are here. Oh, they are for a Japanese kid who was killed by the US bombing of Hiroshima. Poor kid. For what sin innocent kids are killed? Even in Iran, the city of Sardasht was targeted by the chemical bombs of Saddam, and many kids were killed. Oh, poor kids. And here's a photo gallery. It has explanations. Can be illuminating. And here you can see the bust of Iranian poets. Great! The bust of Hafiz, who composed friendly poems. And the bust of Sa'di, the great Iranian poet, who both, I mean, Hafiz and Sa'di have universal reputation. Well, art is long and life is short. To know more about the details, take a tour to this museum. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, the community, and most importantly, the people. And in today's episode, we will be discussing two major issues pertaining to India's economy and the Kashmir situation. So, stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss public procurement as part of a free trade agreement of India with different countries. And we shall also take a look at, contrary to the BJP claims, deterioration in the economic and security state of Jammu and Kashmir.
A free trade agreement pact signed between India and the UAE last year has set alarm bells ringing for the big Indian companies. Being India's third largest trading partner, New Delhi last year opened UAE's access to India's public procurement market, displaying a major shift in its trade policy stance. Exports benefiting from the India-UAE free trade pact accounted for about 60% of New Delhi's total non-oil shipments to Abu Dhabi in the December quarter last year.
The India-UAE Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement aims to increase bilateral trade to $100 billion from the current $60 billion in the next 5 years. The UAE is currently the third largest trading partner of India and second largest export destination. After keeping the public procurement market out of FTAs for a long time, India recently opened up access to public tenders over $2 billion to foreign companies as part of the negotiations. Big Indian business houses now face the challenge of foreign competition in acquiring government contracts as Delhi has extended national treatment to the UAE companies. Experts say that maintaining the $2 billion limit will safeguard small and medium-sized industries from the pressure of foreign competition.
We see basically moves that are playing out which seemed to be calculated to give a fundamental business advantage to Atlantic world corporations, which are no longer able to compete with emerging economies. So when these deals are done, they're done. It's basically kowtowing again to Uncle Sam and the British and the French, and for that matter, Israel and the economic union, which have, of course, have had over 500 years of dominance to get things right and have done nothing but mess up. And I have to confess, as a person of European descent, you know, I'm part of that and I'm taking the benefit of it. But it's time for a change. And the kind of change that's required is not breaking down traditional values in regional countries and clearing the way or so that multinational corporations from the United States and Great Britain and Europe more generally can come in and do business with billionaires in places like India, so that at the top end of the human scrap heap, they're lapping it all up and doing well and saying GDP is growing, while people at the bottom are suffering more than ever with rising prices and lower wages. So I don't think this is the way to go. I see it happening around the world. I see it happening here in Indonesia. I see a calculated effort to break down traditional values and clear the way with false promises for Western corporations to come in and cover the field and establish monopolies and oligopolies that basically put small businesses out of business.
According to Indian economists, foreign firms won't be able to compete with the local firms, thus incurring higher costs compared to national companies. Underwater structure projects involving large-scale medical equipment or artificial intelligence are the areas where the foreign companies have an edge over the local businesses. Cost being the major factor, the competition in majority of sectors is with ASEAN countries or China. As per the agreement, procurement has been open to UAE companies in 34 central government ministries, including Ministry of Economic Affairs, New and Renewable Energy, Power, etc.
Allowing access to the UAE to procure government tenders has resulted in the opening of the floodgates to similar demands from other countries India is negotiating with. These include the European Union, the UK and Australia. The agreement with the UAE is being used as a benchmark by other negotiating countries. Additionally, countries with which India already has FTAs may push for including access to $500 billion Indian government procurement market in the agreements.
In a surprising move, India and the European Union resumed negotiations in June 2022 for a free trade agreement after almost a decade. EU's demands include inclusion of concessions extended to other FTA partners, namely UAE, along with duty cuts on automobiles, dairy products. India also has ongoing talks with the UK, Australia, and Canada. All these countries are eyeing the Indian central government procurement market. According to the Indian government officials, the UK and EU will not negotiate if the public procurement market is kept out of the trade talks. Australia has also been asking for similar access as given to the UAE.
Well, I think it's very difficult to ever conceive of a situation that has large corporations facing a threat from smaller, more efficient companies. I don't think the business sector, the private sector works that way. The way corporatism works, basically, is huge corporations come into a country, whether it's by making promises or through corrupt payments or whatever it takes, and initially perform in order to be able to say, look, we're delivering a better product at the lower price, which helps everybody, including consumers. But once they've established themselves, they're like a caterpillar or a moth. They metamorphosize into something horrible that destroys all other possibilities, including local smaller businesses. It's very difficult for small businesses to survive, let alone threaten the supremacy of big corporations in a place where corporations have been allowed to come in and basically dominate the roost. So I don't see there being a scenario once these multinational corporations start coming in and doing trade with India, which understandably is primarily concerned about its own economic interests, that sees ordinary small businesses and medium-sized businesses and domestic businesses and individuals protected from what's going to play out. This is all part of the grander scheme for U.S. hegemony, or if you like, Atlantic world hegemony, where everybody's dancing to a set of rules that's drafted in America.
According to the experts, if a national treatment clause is included in the FDA's, it would mean similar treatment to foreign small companies. Given that foreign micro, small, and medium enterprises are very strong, it would create stiff competition for their domestic counterparts. The economists regard this as the real cause of concern, as providing a particular area means agreement to give access to other areas. Public procurement, being a huge market, is always preferred. In both scenarios, Indian businesses face danger of foreign entities entering the domestic market and increasing competition.
So we have discussed public procurement as part of free trade agreements of India with different countries. Now, let's switch to social media and see what people around the world had to say on this issue.
Let's now take a look at what the global media has to say about it. Mark Warner tweeted, "Public procurement of contracts worth over 200 crore rupees were opened up in the FTA signed with the UAE last year, and now every country India is negotiating with, including the EU, UK and Australia, is gunning for access to the public procurement market." John G. Murphy, an economic expert, wrote, "UK expects to strike FTA with India and accede to TPP in 2023, reports Bloomberg. The administration's view that FTAs are passé is a lonely one." Shantanu Singh, an economist, tweeted, "People aware of the development said that Indian companies, especially those in the IT sector, have also sought access to the public procurement market in the EU and the UK." Mint, a news portal, wrote, "The inclusion of public procurement in the UAE agreement marked a first for India, which has been notoriously shy of opening up this lucrative market to foreign companies."
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Contrary to the claims of the Modi-led BJP government, the intensity of attacks on the civilian population in Jammu and Kashmir has increased in recent years. These attacks have mainly been aimed on the minority Kashmiri Pandit community and the non-resident Hindus living in Kashmir. Experts say that the armed group's strategy to attack the non-locals and minorities is a way to signal opposition to the means employed by the Bharatiya Janata Party to change the demography of the Muslim-majority region.
With the start of the new year, the state of Jammu and Kashmir witnessed the killing of four civilians in the Rajouri district by unidentified gunmen. Two more people, including a child, died the following day when a blast rocked the area. Conflicting with the return of normalcy as claimed by the BJP government, at least 18 non-local Hindus and Kashmiri Pandits have been killed since the abrogation of Article 370. According to the data provided by the government of India, the violence has seen no downward trend since the revocation of the statehood in the year 2019. The Modi-led BJP government had cited the special status of Jammu and Kashmir as the primary reason for violence. 229 armed attacks were recorded in the year 2021, leading to 40 civilian killings. The number went to 30 civilian killings in the year 2022. In the years 2017 and 2016, 279 and 322 attacks were reported, thus showing no significant improvement in the situation, as wrongly portrayed by New Delhi. The central BJP government has been asserting that the abrogation of Article 370 brought normalcy to the violence-ridden region. However, the opposite appears to be true. In the year 2013, prior to Modi's coming to power, only 170 cases of violence were reported from the Himalayan region.
Contrary to the popular belief that the COVID-19 pandemic has wreaked havoc to the economy of Jammu and Kashmir, statistics show a different picture. After the abrogation of Article 370, the investments in the region dropped from $72.3 million in 2018-2019 to $36.3 million in the year 2019-2020. According to the government of India's recent figures, the investment has decreased by more than 50% since the revocation of the special status of the Himalayan region.
The claim that the abrogation of the semi-autonomous status of the state will lead to economic development in the region has failed on the ground. Last year in December, India's Minister of State for Home Affairs, Nityanand Rai, gave figures about the economic status of Jammu and Kashmir. According to the statistics, the investments in the region have fallen by 55% in the past 4 years. Previously blaming the local governments for the economic backwardness in the region, the BJP government in New Delhi has not been able to put the Union Territory directly ruled by the centre on the road to economic development as had been promised earlier. According to the data published by the Indian Ministry of Home Affairs, the total investment in the year 2017 to 2018 was $102.8 million, considerably decreasing to $50.5 million in the year 2019 to 2022. And in 2021 to 2022, the investments were recorded to be $46 million, thus laying bare the false claims of economic growth in the region. Earlier, Modi-led BJP government would cite restrictions on the procurement of land as the main reason for economic backwardness of the Himalayan region. However, after the abrogation of Article 370, the government still has not been able to bring private sector investment to the state, thus ruining the economy further.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, contrary to the rosy picture painted by the BJP government, the civilian killings of the non-resident Hindus and Kashmir Pandits have increased. So the question is, do you think the armed groups have changed their tactics after the abrogation of Article 370?
First of all, we all should condemn the killing of civilian for whatever pretext somebody is doing this. Nobody can justify killings of civilians by any means, whether they are Pandits or non-Kashmiri residents or whoever. Having said this, that I think that the civilian Pandits, Kashmiri Pandits, or the non-resident Kashmiris are being made cannon fodder by the Indian government. Indian government has a plan to change the demography of occupied state of Jammu and Kashmir. For that, they are bringing in non-Kashmiris in the state of Jammu and Kashmir. And they have changed not just the state of the disputed state, but also they have changed the laws about the domiciles and the residence. So that has enabled them to bring non-resident Kashmiris. And by doing this, actually the BJP government is fueling tension between different religions. So because the demographic changes being made in Kashmir are based on the religion, because predominantly Kashmir is a Muslim majority state, and which should have been something India could have taken pride in that, that it has a state which is majority Muslim state, and that suited the Indian claim of secularism. But since the BJP is in power, which is a Hindu fascist and nationalist government, they are trying to change the demography on the basis of Hindu Muslims. So they are bringing in more Hindus, and which are actually creating troubles for the Hindu pandits, which are Kashmiris and very much state subject. They lived there for centuries, and they used to have very cordial relations with the Muslim majority of the state of Jammu and Kashmir. But now they are also in trouble because of these political policies of BJP, which I think which will not only backfire within Kashmir, but elsewhere in India as well.
Now, Mr. Khan, citing the special status as a roadblock to the economic development of the region, statistics show that investments in the region have fallen by 55%. Now, conflicting with the claims, has the withdrawal of the special status been responsible for the decrease in economic investments?
Hey, you know, this is very interesting that the BJP says that after abrogation of special status to Kashmir, they will bring in investment. While destroying the economy of Kashmiri traders and Kashmiri businessmen for almost now 10 years, consistently destroying the local economy, how can you actually improve the economic condition of the state or the people of the state? This is, I think, not understandable to common sense that local economy, you know, the blockade of the Kashmiri traders, it remained for months. And the Kashmir is practically in siege for almost 2 years now, and 2.5 years now. And you claim that you will bring investment, and that is not possible. And as you mentioned, the statistics have shown that it is not possible. Actually, it is hypocrisy at its best. Whatever the BJP government is trying to do in Kashmir is actually to strengthen its occupation. And for that, their sole objective is to weaken the will of the local people by whatever means. And they are trying to bring in, as I earlier mentioned, non-resident people. And now they are trying to bring in the business community of India into Kashmir while depriving the local businessmen of their own businesses. This is ridiculous. You cannot actually prosper as a state or a territory while the local people are deprived of their basic livelihoods and you are bringing in other investors. That's not possible. And this is the, this is the basic objective the Modi had presented Kashmir as a business hub for non-resident business community to come in and to benefit from the tourism and other businesses available in Kashmir. And the sole objective is actually to destroy the local businesses. Now, I think that will not work. Whatever India try, that will not work for India and not for the people of the Kashmir.
Mr. Khan, we've seen that violence in the region has not improved in the past few years, as claimed by the BJP government. So has the centre's iron fist policy turned counterproductive in the Himalayan region?
History is a teacher, but we tend not to listen from it, not to learn from it. Everybody knows that you cannot crush the will of the people by iron fist or whatever strict policies you adopt. This is not for the first time India is adopting very strict policies. India killed more than 100,000 people in Kashmir, but the Kashmiri people never, ever, bore down in front of Indian pressure. They still demand their right of self-determination, and this is the will of the people. You know, whatever India uses sometimes stick, sometimes carrot, policy for the people of Kashmir. Sometimes they try to appease them, sometimes they try to coerce them. But both have failed in the past and both will fail in future as well, because the people of Jammu and Kashmir want to have their right of self-determination. And India should actually give them their the opportunity to exercise their right, which India itself had committed under the UN Security Council resolutions. And it was basically India which took the Kashmir issue into United Nations, not Pakistan. India was losing the war at that time because the Kashmiri people had taken up arms and this Azad Kashmir and Gilgit Baltistan, that was liberated by the people. And India was fearful that Srinagar was about to fall, and when India took that to UN Security Council, now India is obliged to fulfill its own commitments at international forums, which India is denying and which will cost India miserably in the future.
Now, Mr. Khan, last but not least, the incidence of violence in Kashmir has seen a downward trend before Modi's coming to power. So the question is, has the anti-Muslim policy of the BJP further alienated the people of the region and pushed them to the wall?
Actually, if we see the violence of the Kashmiri militant groups against the Indian state, that is irrespective of who is in power in the center, whether it is BJP, whether it is Congress, whether it is a united front of different political parties. The Kashmiri people are actually resistant against the occupation of India, and they want to exercise their right of self-determination, which was deprived by India. So the basic thing is that the militant groups, they will carry their work, whether it is BJP, whether it is some other government. But having said that, the strict policies which in BJP has applied on Kashmir, it actually helped the militant groups to recruit more and more Kashmiri youth. There was a time that then there was a mix of non-Kashmiri and Kashmiri militants. Now we are seeing that majority of the militants operating in Kashmir are purely the Kashmiri youth. So that is a phenomena which changed during the BJP's government, that more youth is being radicalized in Kashmir and they are joining different militant groups. And this is for the first time in the history of Kashmir that during BJP's government, we have seen the presence of Daesh in Kashmir and we have seen presence of Al-Qaeda in Kashmir. It never happened. So that is the level of, suppression and depression among the Kashmiri youth, which can actually become catastrophic for India and for the region as well. So that is something which is new in Kashmir, and that is the result of the BJP's policies.
There you have it, Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the managing director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sharp Media Network tweeted, "No developments in Indian illegally occupied Jammu and Kashmir during last 4 years. The last 4 years have ruined the entire economy of Jammu and Kashmir, which has in reality collapsed. Unemployment is at its peak and youth is in utter frustration." Frontier Indica wrote, "It's no secret that under Modi, the security situation in Punjab has gotten much worse, and the benefits of revocation of Article 370 vis-a-vis the safety of common people in J&K, especially KPs, have also been short-lived." The Wire, a prominent news portal, tweeted, "The people of Kashmir say silence, fear, rising prices, and unemployment have taken over the region after August 5, 2019. Jammu-based reserve category employee working in Kashmir tweeted, "Situation in Kashmir is not yet conducive, but still being forced to resume duties. I don't know why. We are not with NEZ security and weapon to defend ourselves, still forced by stopping salaries. Our life is also valuable to our old parents, if yours matters to your parents."
And that was our episode about the FTA's public procurement and the apprehensions of Indian business houses, and also the worrying economic and security situation in Jammu and Kashmir. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice.
www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The navies of China, Russia, and South Africa will hold their second joint maritime military exercises in the airspace and waters east of the South Africa, China's defense ministry has said recently. The exercises are targeted at jointly safeguarding the security of shipping and maritime economic activities, it said. It added, the joint exercise will help further promote defense and security cooperation between BRICS countries and enhance the capacity of participating parties to jointly safeguard maritime security. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, China's defense ministry announced recently that the second joint naval exercise between China, Russia, and South Africa will be held from Monday, February 20th to February 2017, aiming to safeguard sea transport and maritime economic activities amid the intensive efforts of the Chinese People's Liberation Army, PLA, to restore exchanges and cooperation with foreign countries, including opening a destroyer to the public at an international expo in Abu Dhabi after such interactions were hindered by the pandemic in recent years. Amid the hypes from Western countries, which claim that such exercise is controversial, Chinese analysts stress that China has its free will to conduct joint drills with any friendly countries, and that the exercise will contribute to peace and stability in the region and the protection of sea lanes for commercial ships, and is not related to conflicts or tensions elsewhere in the world. According to agreements reached by China, Russia, and South Africa, the navies of the three countries will start their second joint naval exercise in sea and air regions east of South Africa's Durban and the Richards Bay from February 20 to February 27. China's Ministry of National Defense said in a press release recently, the theme of this exercise is a joint security operation on safeguarding sea transport and maritime economic activities, the ministry said. The Type 052D destroyer, Honan, the Type 054A frigate, Rizhao, and the Type 903A comprehensive replenishment ship, Keke Jihu, of the PLA Navy's 42nd Escort Task Force, will participate in the drills, according to the press release. It is conducive to further promoting cooperation in the fields of defense and security among BRICS members and enhancing all participating parties' capabilities in jointly safeguarding maritime security, read the press release. Codenamed MOSI-2, the joint naval exercise will schedule to begin in the Indian Ocean off the coast of South Africa, said South Africa's defense ministry. Russian news agency TASS reported recently. The trilateral exercise will benefit all participating countries by aligning their operational naval systems and improving joint command and control, TASS quoted South Africa's Minister of Defense and military veterans, Thandi Motsi, as saying. The drills will run until February 27th, with China sending a destroyer, a frigate, and a support ship, South Africa represented by a frigate and two support ships, and Russia deploying a frigate and a tanker, according to TASS, which also noted that the Russian frigate will demonstrate the Zircon hypersonic missile. It is the second time the three countries have held a joint naval exercise, with the first one held in November 2019 in the southwest of South Africa in the Atlantic Ocean, TASS reported. The joint drills will contribute to peace and stability in the region, as the three countries have common interests in protecting sea lanes involving key commercial activities in the Indian Ocean from piracy and other security threats, a Beijing-based military expert told the Global Times recently. Western countries and their media have been hyping the exercise as controversial, citing the Russia-Ukraine crisis, South Africa's refusal to condemn and impose sanctions on Russia, and tensions over the Taiwan question. But these are just accusations that the West has made against this peacefully intended exercise, the expert said. The drill is not related to any other ongoing situation, and it is also very normal for China to conduct joint exercises with friendly countries, the experts have recently said. Also, recently, the PLA's Navy Type 052D guided missile destroyer Nanning arrived in Abu Dhabi to participate in Naval Defense and Maritime Security Exhibition, NAVDEX, under the invitation of the host country. The Nanning will conduct friendly interactions, including seminars, visits, and sports competitions with the Navy, and vessels from other countries participating in AAVDEX, and will be open to the general public. Senior Colonel Liu Wensheng, a PLA's Navy spokesperson, announced recently. The Nanning is part of the PLA Navy 43rd Naval Escort Task Force to Aden and the waters of Somalia, and has just participated in Amman 23 Multinational Maritime Exercise, which was hosted by Pakistan and attended by some 50 countries from February 10th to February 20th. Intensive foreign interactions, including participation in joint drills and international exhibitions, show that PLA is proactively boosting its military exchange and cooperation with other countries in the post-COVID era, as it continues to open to the world, providing positive factors to enhance understanding and manage differences.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the newsline.
Protesters have returned to major cities across Europe to voice their anger at the rising cost of living across the continent. In Spain, people held a massive rally in Madrid against what they call the regional government's dismantling of the public health care system. Officials say 250,000 people turned out, but organizers put the number as high as a million. That is the largest such demonstration in recent months. Protesters accuse the regional government of prioritizing private health. They say the public health service is suffering from staff and equipment shortages because of the government's policies. Some primary care doctors and healthcare workers have also been holding regular strikes over better working conditions and pay.
The condition of the public health system is deteriorating. The number of doctors have been decreasing with medical conditions getting worse. Many medical centers have been closed.
The region's right-wing leader has repeatedly claimed that the protesters are motivated by political interests. And in the Portuguese city of Lisbon, tens of thousands of teachers have taken to the streets amid public discontent over the cost of living crisis. It is the third time in less than a month that teachers and school workers have held mass demonstrations. Teachers want a pay rise and are also calling on the government to speed up career progression. Officials say negotiations with teachers' unions are ongoing and express hope that an agreement would be reached soon. Portugal is one of Western Europe's poorest countries, which is seeing decades-high inflation and is grappling with the cost of living crisis.
We are here to claim our rights, which were taken away from us a long time ago. Our careers have been frozen for a long time, and that can't be. We have the right to have a more dignified career. We can't work like this. It just can't be.
Protests in Spain and Portugal come as passengers across Germany have witnessed widespread travel chaos after a major trade union called on airport workers to go on a strike over a pay dispute. Verdi Trade Union called for the industrial action after it said collective bargaining efforts to settle wage disputes with the government failed. Since last year, European airlines have been facing labor strife amid staff shortages and soaring inflation, which have prompted employees to demand higher wages. German officials say despite a recent improvement, the economy is expected to suffer another mild decline in early 2023, as energy prices for households are still increasing. German consumer prices, harmonized to compare with other European Union countries, peaked at 11.6% in October, driven by the surge in energy prices and rising input costs. In the UK, more than 70% of UK households fear that they will be severely hit by the cost of living crisis in the first part of 2023, up from 54% at the end of last year.
Nobody actually wants to be on strike. We want to do our jobs. We want to look after the students here. This is what our passion is. But we've been driven into a situation where we can't even pay our bills now. So basically, we've been forced to do this. Nobody works in education to be rich, but we'd like to have a decent standard of life. And I think we're losing a lot of staff as well. A lot of people are leaving because of the pay.
Meanwhile, in France, police clashed with people protesting the government's pension reform bill. Hundreds of thousands of people attended the rally, which was held in a number of other cities across France, seeking to keep up pressure on the government over the reform plan, which aims to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. President Emmanuel Macron says the reform is vital to ensuring the viability of the pension system.
We would like the age of retirement to remain the same. 62 is already enough for working people like us. We work in kindergarten in the way, and we don't see ourselves working with children at 64. It's already quite hard currently, and going farther isn't possible.
This is a democracy, and people only have a month to debate the pension reform. The government has kept its project hidden for months, despite the fact that it was ready, and they only yield on details when people take to the streets. Well, we will keep going.
The economic crises have been compounded by the protracted war in Ukraine. The war has pushed up prices, including the price of commodities like energy products. Furthermore, European nations have pledged billions of dollars worth of military aid to Ukraine, and that has sapped the capacities of European major economies to spend money on social welfare programs. The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, visited China for an official three-day state visit aimed at building up bilateral ties. The Iranian president arrived in Beijing earlier on Tuesday as the head of a high-ranking politico-economic delegation on an official invitation by his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in Beijing. Speaking to reporters before leaving Tehran for Beijing, Raisi said that Iran and China have similar views on fighting unilateralism at the international level. During the trip, the two countries sought to operationalize the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement, which was finalized in March 2021 in a bid to strengthen their long-standing economic and political alliance. The $400 billion deal will pave the way for Iran's Joining the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Xi and Raisi attended the signing of 20 cooperation agreements, adding to a 25-year partnership agreement to cooperate in developing oil, industry, and other fields. The two sides signed a number of bilateral cooperation documents in the fields of agriculture, trade, tourism, environmental protection, health, disaster relief, culture, and sports. The Chinese leader said Beijing opposes external forces interfering in Iran's internal affairs and undermining Iran's security and stability. And President Ebrahim Raisi said that Iran and China are friends in hard times, stressing that further strengthening of relations between the two countries will contribute to the security of the region and the world. The visit comes amid rapid geopolitical shifts in the wake of protracted Ukraine war and the end of the unipolar world order led by the U.S. and its Western allies. China is now among Iran's top trading partners. Since 2022, the 10-month figure of trade between the two nations stands at $25.3 billion. That figure has surpassed the volume of trade between Iran and its other neighboring countries, like the UAE, Turkey, and Iraq. Since March of last year, Iran imported $12.7 billion worth of goods from China, and its exports to Beijing stood at $12.8 billion. President Raisi took office back in 2021, and since then he has tried to readjust Iran's foreign policy with a focus on eastern countries, which has come to be known as the Look to the East policy. It aims to forge alliances with non-Western countries, especially China and Russia. Moreover, Iran is joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a key regional bloc where China is a co-founder. The bloc is a counterweight against U.S.-led security and economic blocs and could significantly reduce the hegemony of the U.S. in Asia. SCO member countries account for more than 40% of the world's population and contribute about 30% of the global gross domestic product, GDP. It's widely believed that Iran's close partnerships with countries like China will significantly erode Western hegemony and pave the way for a new world order.
Foreign ministers from France, Germany, Italy, and the United Kingdom have followed the United States in denouncing the planned expansion of Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. In a statement, the ministers said, "We strongly oppose these unilateral actions, which will only serve to exacerbate tensions between Israelis and Palestinians and undermine efforts to achieve a negotiated two-state solution. We continue to support a comprehensive, just, and lasting peace in the Middle East, which must be achieved through direct negotiations between the parties." Norwegian Foreign Minister also condemned Israel's plans, saying the Israeli settlement policy on occupied land is contrary to international law and must be stopped. The Israeli settlement plans have also drawn condemnation from the Arab world. However, Israel's controversial right-wing minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said he wanted to see more Jewish settlements.
"I say to Americans and Europeans, stop worrying. This is our mission. This is our doctrine. Nine settlements are nice, but it's not enough. We want much more."
The comments fly in the face of international calls for a de-escalation of tensions between Israelis and the Palestinians after months of violence in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The international community views the settlements, hundreds of which have been built across the West Bank since Tel Aviv's occupation of the territory in 1967, as illegal under international law and the Geneva Conventions due to their construction on the occupied territories. The UN Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Hossein al-Sheikh, a senior Palestinian official, welcomed the joint statement by Western powers condemning Tel Aviv's plan to build more illegal settlements, but said action needed to be taken. In a statement on Twitter, he said, "We demand that words be turned to deeds." Hardliners who oppose Palestinian statehood comprise a large part of Israel's new cabinet, which has put settlement construction at the top of its priorities. Extremist Israeli minister Bezalel Smotrich said about 10,000 new homes are to be approved. Smotrich said he and his allies were committed to removing completely the restrictions on building in the occupied West Bank. Today, between 600,000 and 750,000 Israelis live in these seizable settlements, equivalent to roughly 11% of the total Jewish Israeli population. The Palestinians seek those territories for a future independent state. Since then, the Tel Aviv regime has openly funded and built settlements for Israeli Jews to live there, offering incentives and subsidized housing. Their statements by the Western powers will likely have little effect on the Israeli hardliners. The regime has never been subjected to real sanctions or accountability. The Israelis have never suffered any pressure, so they keep doing what they're doing. 2022 was the deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank since the United Nations started keeping records in 2005. Over 140 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank last year. But already this year, we are only halfway through the second month of 2023, and Israel has already killed around 50 Palestinians in the West Bank. Israel has also regularly bombed Gaza, and now, with a right-wing cabinet in place, the situation is only expected to get worse. Israel's far-right cabinet has approved the legislation for 9 settler outposts in the occupied West Bank. All settlements are illegal according to international law, but who pays attention to international law in this occupied land? Years of war in Syria has destabilized the region, which is still suffering from an ongoing humanitarian emergency. Millions are displaced within Syria or have fled to Turkey, which is contending with high inflation and a deepening economic crisis. The earthquake unleashed widespread damage and destruction in some of the most at-risk areas in the region. A magnitude 7.8 earthquake struck near Nurdaghi in southern Turkey around 4:17 a.m. local time on February 6th. A magnitude 7.5 earthquake followed around later that afternoon around 1 p.m. local time, along with scores of powerful aftershocks. Thousands are injured and thousands more remain trapped in the rubble, and the chance of finding survivors gets narrower and narrower. Search and recovery operations continue with assistance from teams around the world. But freezing weather is hampering rescue efforts and making it even more difficult to access possible survivors. This catastrophe hit an already fragile region, which has been marred by decades of war in Syria and economic, humanitarian, and public health crises. Turkey is facing a profound economic crisis, with a collapsing currency and extraordinary inflation that hit around 80% last year, the highest in about 25 years. The quake-hit part of Turkey also hosts a large population of Syrian refugees. The economic crisis in Turkey has helped fuel a backlash against the approximately 3.6 million Syrian refugees in the country, who are already facing poverty, discrimination, an increase in violent attacks, and the risk of deportation. More than 2 million people in northwestern Syria are also at risk of a deadly cholera outbreak. The outbreak began in northeastern Syria, attributed to contaminated water from the Euphrates River, which people were relying on in part because of the water infrastructure destroyed by years of fighting. About 47% of people in Syria rely on unsafe drinking water, a potentially even bigger risk after the massive infrastructure damage by the earthquake. In northwest Syria, in particular, this outbreak was straining an already stretched and under-resourced health system, which will now also need to find ways to treat those injured in the earthquake. The devastation extends beyond northwest Syria, as the country as a whole has been overwhelmed by years of war and destruction. International sanctions against Syria are also deepening the economic crisis Syrians face. The country faces record and widespread poverty and food shortages. About 90% of Syrians live below the poverty line, and nearly 75% struggle to meet their most basic needs. And across the region, the crisis